OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 143 of Sign Language. This is my third attempt to record this podcast. The first attempt, I didn't quite have my thoughts together, and I was a little bit all over the shop, and I actually went ahead and mixed it all down and then thought to myself in the, you know, cold, sober light of the following morning that, no, that was actually quite crap. I think we'll try that again. But then in between that point and attempting to record it for the second time, I was mucking around with the buffer settings on my sound card, trying to get real-time monitoring of effect plugins during recording. And in the process of just experimenting with some stuff, I set the buffer to its absolute minimum and promptly forgot to set it back to where it should have been. And then went ahead and recorded the second attempt at this podcast with the buffer set to its absolute minimum, and all of the audio came out sounding, well, like this. The second tool is called Paul Stretch, which you used to have to download independently, but lo and behold, Audacity has it already built in. So, lesson learned for the newbies. Don't try and record with your sound card set to its absolute minimum buffer, because that's what's going to happen to your audio. So I was mildly unimpressed when I found that that had happened to, you know, the entire 40 minutes of monologue that I'd just recorded. Okay, so what did I have to discuss this week? Well, in the last 2 weeks, I got an email from Bill Wenzel, who has long been a listener to not only Sign Language, but Building the Pod prior to that. Although I don't think Bill uses Audition. I know he's now using Logic Pro 10. And he alerted me to a series of 3 videos that he produced and put up on YouTube. And Bill is, yeah, he's an older guy. He's a little bit older than me, and he's an analog purist. He loves his analog. And Bill still has a TAC 3440 4-track quarter-inch reel-to-reel tape machine. I think it's quarter-inch. I might be wrong. Might be half-inch. I don't know. But it's a 4-track tape machine. And he's obviously had it for a long time, and he loves the sound of it. He likes to play acoustic guitar. And so what he did as a bit of an experiment was recorded a performance of himself playing acoustic guitar into a couple of small diaphragm condenser mics as a spaced pair, into a Focusrite Sapphire audio interface, and tracked it straight into Logic Pro 10 at 96K 24-bit. But at the very same time, he took a split of those microphone feeds out of the mic pre's and fed them into his TAC tape machine. So he got the exact same performance, picked up by the exact same microphones at the exact same time and space, both as a digital recording and as an analog recording. He then dumped the analog recording into the computer at 96K 24-bit, lined them up, and was then able to A-B the two, the one recorded direct to digital and the one that was recorded to tape and then dumped into the computer. Now, when I listened to the two of them, it was obvious to me the moment the tape version started, because the tape hiss gave the game away straight away to me. But gotta say, I did like the analog recording. You know, now, gotta say, after it's been compressed by YouTube, who's to say, you know, how much of that analog sound you're really still hearing, you know? I'm not sure what sort of bit rate compression YouTube uses for its audio. But anyway, the whole point was Bill, you know, compared the two. Then he went on to using the Waves Kramer Master Tape plugin, which is designed as an analog tape machine emulation. So it allows you to dial in bias and tape speed and, you know, tape hiss and all that sort of stuff. And so what Bill did was to try and emulate the sound of his analog recording using the Kramer Master Tape plugin on the all digital file to see how close he could get. It was an interesting experiment, and it was interesting viewing for anyone who has an interest in that sort of stuff. So thank you for that, Bill. I'll put the link in the show notes to anyone who wants to go and check it out for themselves. Something else I came across through the week was a video that I saw it posted on Facebook, but it was also posted on YouTube, and so I've found the YouTube link, which will be in the show notes. And this was of the guy, you may have very well have seen this. I mean, you know, knowing the nature of the internet, this might have been out there for 2 years. I don't know. It just came across my radar this week. Of a guy who got his iPhone, put it into video record mode, and then stuck it inside his acoustic guitar. He was obviously outside on a bright sunny day. Had the video camera basically pointing at the strings as they appear over the F-hole in the guitar. It was not an F-hole, but the sound hole in the guitar, so that you could see the strings as he then proceeded to play the acoustic guitar. Now, what was really interesting was that as he played, the 30 frames per second recording that you get with video created aliasing in the movement of the strings. Aliasing in a visual sense, not in an audio sense. I trust that you all have a concept of how video aliasing works. You've seen, you know, Western movies where the stagecoach is traveling forwards, but it looks like the wheels are rotating backwards. Okay, so hopefully I don't need to explain how that works or why that happens. If you're not up to speed on how that works, sing out and I'll explain it in the next episode. But basically, there was this really interesting aliasing artifact occurring where as this guy played the strings of the acoustic guitar, you saw all these random shapes on the strings, and they weren't just, you know, sine waves like you would imagine. You know, if you imagine when you pluck the string of an acoustic guitar, it vibrates in a sinusoidal pattern. But because of the aliasing of the video frame rate, you got to see all these really weird shapes to the strings. It was awesome. If you haven't seen it, definitely go and check it out. It only goes for, I don't know, a minute or so, and you don't really need to watch all of it. You only have to watch 10, 15 seconds to get the effect. I thought it was really cool. You know, recently I was talking about, you know, lust for new gear, and I was talking about the thought of getting rid of the TRP preamp and replacing it with something else. I then, I think in the last episode, said that no, I'd had a change of heart. I was not going to go and frivolously spend money. And I'm, you know, going to be content with what I've got. I'm on an email distribution list, just a, you know, marketing list, for ProSound Web. Now, I think most of you have probably heard of ProSound Web. If you've ever heard of the Diaries of Mixer Man, that was famously hosted on the forums at ProSound Web, which was how I came to know of ProSound Web. Someone told me about the Mixer Man Diaries, and I went off in search for them, and you know, ended up at ProSound Web, and was quite active on those forums for a while. Haven't been there in years, but as a part of being a member of that forum, I've ended up on this marketing list. So every day I get an email of new audio news from ProSound Web. Something that came up through the week was an announcement of a new unit from Neve, and this is the 1073 DPX, and this is one yummy looking piece of gear, let me tell you. as soon as I saw the headline, I thought, oh, I've got to go and check this one out. And I had a look at the specs for this thing. It is seriously nice looking gear, and I, you know, and being Neve, I'm fairly certain it would be pretty awesome sounding gear as well. I won't run through all the specs. If you, you know, like your audio porn, follow the link, go and have a look. If I was genuinely going to go down the route of buying a new pre, that would probably be very high on my list of, you know, lusted after gear, I think, because that's pretty much what I was looking for, was a good two-channel, you know, mic pre and EQ. Admittedly, I don't need the EQ because I've got my API EQ, but hey, you can never have too many toys. So anyway, go check that one out. While we are on that subject, though, Rowan Matthews brought to my attention a few weeks ago the Cloudlifter, the CL1, which is made by Cloud Microphones. And they call it a mic activator. And essentially what it's designed to do is give you an extra 25 dB of gain in circumstances where, you know, A, you're using a passive mic like a ribbon or a dynamic, something that, you know, generally needs a fair bit of gain to get happening. B, your mic pre might not have the best signal to noise ratio and it's a little bit noisy. This thing will give you 25 dB of gain, which is apparently very clean. I've yet to plug it in. Or C, you might be running your, you know, a really long mic cable run. And, you know, the longer the cable run, then the more your signal degrades simply because of distance and resistance in the cable. And this unit will help to amplify that signal close to the microphone to push it back to wherever your mic pre is located. So, on the advice of Rowan, I went out and ordered one off eBay, and it arrived this evening. So I have yet to plug it in. I'm going to plug it in just a minute. So what you're hearing at the moment is my R84 ribbon mic through the TRP, the ribbon pre from AEA, which is my usual setup, okay? And that signal, as per normal, is going through the API EQ and then the Safe Sound Dynamics toolbox and then into my sound card. So I shall now take a little break and plug in the Cloudlifter. All right, I'm back. What I'm noticing is that the EQ is completely different, and that's partly because the EQ circuit in the VoiceMaster Pro has fixed frequencies for the two middle bands. It's fixed at 1.3K and 3.9K. You've only got sweepable low frequency and high frequency, where I'm used to having, you know, my API 4-band parametric EQ, where I can just dial in whatever frequencies I want for all four bands. So that kind of limits my EQ options, and I've tweaked it, you know, just in that little moment when I was not recording, to try and get it somewhere in the ballpark of the way I thought it was sounding in my headphones when I was tracking, you know, a few minutes ago. The other thing that I notice is that the compression circuit in the VoiceMaster Pro is very, I find it very aggressive, very bitey. And I've got it on slow attack, and the ratio, you've only got a choice of soft ratio and hard ratio. That's it. There's no, you know, potentiometer where you can dial in a ratio. So I've got it on the soft ratio with a slow attack, and I still, you know, looking at the waveform, it looks like it's, you know, compressing harder than I normally drive the Safe Sound Audio Dynamics toolbox. Is that a bad thing? No, well, you know, it's a thing, you know. This is why we have options of gear, so that you can, you know, choose the devices that that work best according to whatever it is that you're trying to track. But I have always had my reservations about the compression circuit in the VoiceMaster Pro. I've always felt it was just a little bit too aggressive for my liking. But anyway, it is what it is. It does the job. So, moving on, I shall continue recording with this for the remainder of this episode. I will be looking forward to playing this back so that I can, you know, hear it not in real time, but on playback, and, you know, then try and judge the two recordings and see what the differences are in terms of gain and signal to noise and all that sort of stuff. Having said that, I've got, you know, computer whirring away in the background, which you can probably hear. and I generally do run an expander across my voice track when I mix down to try and push that noise down a little bit. Yeah, that's probably going to negate any advantage I may have received out of the cloud lifter. But anyway, a couple of other things that I did want to discuss. I think I mentioned last year in the failed first reboot of this podcast, crowd audio. This is in a sort of a community, I guess you would call it, set up by a guy called Bjorgvin, where what he's done is set up an environment whereby artists can come along and say, I've got a song I need mixed. I'm prepared to throw up, you know, so many dollars as a prize pool. And then engineers are welcome to, you know, once they've registered with Crowd Audio, they can express an interest in being a part of the mixing competition, if you want to call it a competition. For that particular song, you then get to download all of the source files, have a crack at mixing the song in whatever DAW, you know, floats your boat, and then you submit your mix to the artist, and then the artist assesses all of the mixes that they've received by the deadline, and chooses a winner. The engineer who mixed it gets the prize pool, and sometimes, you know, they then negotiate a fee for, you know, extra tweaks or whatever. To be honest, I very quickly grew tired of Crowd Audio, not because of the way it was run, but simply because of the ineptitude and lack of education on the part of the artists who were submitting works to be mixed. They were, you know, mixing out mono sources as stereo files, which is, yeah, okay, that's not the worst sin you could commit, but it speaks volumes about their level of understanding. But worse than that, they were, you know, rendering out source files that had processing on them, like, you know, peak limiting and or compression, EQ, and worse, reverbs and delays, you know, which severely limited your options as a mix engineer. You know, and there was just some, yeah, and then you'd get, you know, some source files where the, you know, the peak level was, you know, 30 dB down from full scale and things like that. It was just, it was all over the shop. There was no consistency whatsoever. And it just, yeah, it became more of a headache than an enjoyment for me anyway. I expect that, you know, if I'm going to be given files to mix, that they're going to be prepared properly. So with that in mind, it may even have been one of you guys responding to me after I mentioned Crowd Audio. Someone put me onto the fact that Telefunken, the microphone manufacturer, had on their US website a very similar type of thing happening, where they'd brought some artists into their studio and recorded a song with each of these artists, but they took it one step further. On key sources within each song, so things like acoustic guitars, electric guitars, lead vocals, pianos, they would set up 3, 4, 5 different Telefunken microphones. And they did some very clever stuff with the way they arranged these microphones so as to get, you know, the all of the diaphragms of the, you know, collective series of microphones as close as possible to the sweet spot. Looking at the photos, it was really cool. Anyway, there's a guy called Francis Dunnery who's been around in the American music scene for quite a while, had a bit of a minor hit in the early 90s, I would say, with a song called American Life in the Summertime. Great, great pop song. I don't know if anyone remembers it, but great track. Anyway, Francis Dunnery was one of the artists that Telefunken brought in to record a track, and they did a song of his called Immaculate. Now, I'll be honest, I wasn't really blown away with the song. It was instrumentation-wise, it's the sort of stuff that I'm used to. It was live drums, live bass, two acoustic guitars, one electric guitar, piano, and Frances Dunnery's lead vocal and a female backing vocal. And that was pretty much the lineup. So, you know, fairly standard rock lineup. But the song, yeah, the song didn't really grab me. But I went ahead and I mixed it anyway, because I think it's good to be, you know, to push yourself to go and mix a track that's not exactly your cup of tea, you know, because it makes you, I don't know, can open your eyes a bit, I guess. So anyway, it was a very interesting process. And the beauty of all of the different microphone sources, because every source file was named according to what the source was and what the microphone was that that particular track was recorded from. So you'd get, you know, the acoustic guitar part, you get, you know, four different tracks of the acoustic guitar, one from each of the four microphones that have been set up. And I think with the electric guitar, they did five microphones. With the snare drum, they had three microphones to choose from. And the beauty was that as the mix engineer, you could listen to all of the different microphones for each source and choose which one or which combination you wanted to use in your mix. And you could then go ahead, mix the song as you saw fit. And I think these files were originally posted a couple of years ago, and, you know, the window of opportunity to submit a mix back to Frances Dunnery has long since passed, but the files are still there and available for anyone that wants to grab them and mix them. So I grabbed them, admittedly, a couple of months ago, but just in the last week or so got around to sitting down and throwing my hand at doing a mix. And it was a lot of fun. Even though, like I said, even though the song didn't particularly grab me, it was a lot of fun working through that process and listening to the different microphones and, you know, hearing the way mics had different frequency responses and different characteristics. It was great. And I would highly recommend it to anyone who has an interest in mixing. You know, if you're anything like me, where you want to get into doing more music mixing, definitely go and check it out. And I'm sure there are other places around the web where you can get access to, you know, source files for songs by different bands in different genres. And yeah, I would definitely recommend it. I think it's good to be sort of pushed a little outside of your comfort zone every now and again. I think it helps to just expand your thought processes. Yeah. So anyway, given that this has been public domain for the last couple of years, I don't think there's going to be any issues with me throwing my mix on the tail end of this podcast for anyone that wants to have a listen to it. I'll put it after the closer. So if you don't want to listen to it, you can just skip to your next podcast. Yeah. So anyway, it was a lot of fun. I've also received another absolutely epic email from Rob Bettler. And Rob kindly broke this particular email up into four main topics of conversation. The topics were, number one, mangled adventures in speech recognition. Number two was the toy on stage effect. Number three, our unbearable incredulity about the future. And four, zombie binaural ears and ASMR fetish tribes. There is way too much here, Rob, for me to get through in one episode of the podcast. So we'll start with the first one. So, mangled adventures in speech recognition. So clearly Rob has, you know, an interest in speech recognition technology. And he said to me, like, yeah, last time I sent you a severely mangled message courtesy of Android, often bad speech recognition, which started with me trying to test how accurate it was. And then I switched to just having fun to see how bad it could get. Surprisingly, towards the end, I managed to make it work by speaking to it by stopping after every word, just like a 1960s robot.
or more along the lines of the early TomTom GPS text-to-speech engines. The amazing contradiction of this process is that I had to modify my speech to fit the machine and not the opposite way around. Don't get me wrong, I do have a Mexican-Canadian accent, and most likely Google did not include the Speedy Gonzales language pack. How discriminatory. But after I asked a few friends who have neutral Canadian English accents, they did see an improvement using my method, especially when robotically dictating at a faster speed versus fast normal speech. Don't get me wrong, Bruce, I do agree with Master Gibson
in that he's referring to William Gibson, who said the future is already here, it's just not very evenly distributed.
We already live in the future and it just has bad distribution. My main gripe...
Actually, before I move on with that, I just want to jump in there, Rob, and say I also noticed exactly the same thing, you know, with Google's voice-to-speech conversion, that it doesn't do brilliantly with the Australian accent. It does okay, but I'd put its success rate at somewhere around 65 to 70%. And believe it or not, I have found it to be more accurate if I fake an American accent. I get much more accurate speech-to-text conversion. So there you go. If you're not of American upbringing and you are struggling with your smartphone's, you know, speech-to-text recognition, maybe try throwing on an American accent and just see whether or not Google has a better time with it, because that's certainly been my experience. Anyway, on with Rob's email.
My main gripe is how much speech recognition technology has struggled over the years with the sound of something as complex as human speech, with thousands upon thousands of dialects, which further subdivide into personal inflections, crutches, and word fillers. Thus, the number of sound variations for one single word in English could very well reach thousands of variations. Then imagine this problem multiplied exponentially when we add the variance of pronounced words in most or all languages to the mix. It really is a difficult task, and the way researchers got around it is by predicting the words not by their sound only, but by their context. For example, the chances of someone saying they is instead of they are very slim. Yet it does happen that a few people incorrectly speak like that. So speech recognition gets around the problem by chopping up the words, then analysing the likelihood of the words being used together in normal speech. But truly understanding the sounds of human language has been a roller coaster of hope and disappointment ever since the early days of the Harpy speech recognition revolution in the 70s. Here's a video made by Google explaining the evolution of speech recognition.
Now, I will confess, Rob, I've yet to watch that particular video because I think that one was quite long. I think from memory that was about a half hour. But the link will be in the show notes for anyone that wants to check it out. Rob continues.
Despite Google's attempts to sexy it up with flashy, artish videos, I remain unconvinced the complexities of the sounds that make up human speech will be completely deciphered on the fly unless a few potentially alarming or fascinating technologies are integrated into the mix. Which technologies? Technologies such as electromyographic signal recognition, or in other words, reading the larynx muscles without truly speaking.
This next video is freaky stuff. Just to summarize, in case you haven't got time to go and watch it, there's two guys sitting on a stage. One guy is on a cell phone, which clearly is feeding into a computer. The other guy, who's sitting right beside him, and they are having the conversation, this other guy has got all these electrodes connected to his throat and his neck and his jaw. And when he replies to the first guy's questions, he doesn't actually speak out loud. He simply mouths the words without making any sound. and the computer is picking up on the contraction and expansion of his muscles in his throat and his larynx and converting that into speech. It is really amazing. So I do suggest, if you've got the time, have a look. All right, Rob continues.
The technology is not exclusive to NASA, but they are also researching it, along with many other companies and universities. Why would it be alarming? Because the inevitability, we have to come to the conclusion that sounds are just the facade of the true complexity, the human brain. Deciphering the sounds and words is too superficial when compared to an artificial neural net. Understanding our biological neural net, or said in a less fancy way, why bother with the sound when you can let the computer read what you are thinking? See? Alarming or fascinating, depending on who is reading. The idea of a neural net imitating the human brain is one element of the current apparently superstitious trend of allowing the computer to read your thoughts. This developing trend seems to be slowly inching towards that objective, and perhaps it may eventually end up letting computers read the silent thought of words instead of their pronounced sounds. That form of primitive telepathy has already taken place, allowing two individuals to have a conversation where the computer would read their thoughts, representing the words in question, and send them over as text. Just to brag a little, one conversation partner was in France, the other one was in India.
And then there's a link to that story.
Imagine doing away with the millions of complex pronunciation combinations in all languages and going instead for the core thought the person has. No more interpretation, just pure, unalloyed meaning, if the person has articulated it in their heads beforehand. Now, you may say that a quest that started with deciphering the sounds of mere words may have gone too far, right? What if I told you it has become possible to read not only words in the brain, but also images in it? After showing text and images to a test subject, then reverse engineering the data from the optical nerve into the brain, researchers compared the original with the reverse engineered result, and they succeeded at reading what the brain sees. I cannot insist enough on you watching it, since you have to see it to believe it. Suffice is to say, even Professor Jack Gallant from UC Berkeley was surprised they got any data at all from the brain. Imagine the prospect of getting all sounds from the brain with or without the authorization of the user. How about someone stealing the verbalized thoughts we only tell ourselves? How about our images? How about our dreams? After all, the last frontier is the privacy of our thoughts. Once that one is crossed, almost nothing may remain. On the bright side, ideas, dreams, and concepts that cannot be easily expressed by those who have no artistic training could be massively poured into the real world with boundless beauty. Just imagine fleshing out images and sounds exactly as you see them in your mind without any artistic training. See? The difference between alarming or fascinating depends on how much paranoia we feel by the technology in question. By the way, I'm an out-of-the-closet functional paranoid in that respect.
So that's the end of part one of Rob's massive email. You thought that was long, right? That's only one quarter of it. Thank you, Rob, and thank you for the links. The UC Berkeley video is amazing. Basically, what they do is they set up this apparatus on a test subject. They show them video, and then they map which parts of the brain lit up when observing particular types of images in the video. And then from that, they built an algorithm so that they could show the test subject some other footage, something completely different, but then using the, you know, the patterns of light that light up on the ECG? EKG? whichever one it is that reads brain activity, simply by using that as the roadmap, they could then turn that back into a video image. And then they compared what it was that the test subject was watching with what the computer generated as a video image based on the electrical data in the brain, and the similarities between the input and the output are frightening. Well, as Rob said, frightening or alarming or fascinating, whatever. So anyway, yeah, very interesting discussion, Rob, and thank you very much for the input. And some of the other stuff that you've sent me, I do want to get to in subsequent weeks, but not this week because we'd be here for hours. So I am going to wrap it up here. Like I said, I will put my mix of Francis Dunnery's Immaculate on the tail end of this. If you have any interest, go grab the files. I will do my best to find the link, and I will include those in the show notes for anyone who's interested. And until I speak to you next, take care.
Sign Language.
Another audiotoyou.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com
or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audiotoyou.com.
I moved outside of the circle, and my mind is tied to my necks I've worn. Someone told me I'm different as I hold on tight to the things I own. Look what's sewn in my lining as I let go all of the things I've blown. When no flowers die, grab ya, immaculate, yeah. Grown inside our mind, have a mission on where we're going. Don't take no notice what the man said, 'cause immaculate is sitting in your head. Hey, yeah. Moved outside of the circle, and my mind is tied to my neck's half more. Someone told me I'm different as I let go all of the things I've blown. Where the angels fly, and no homes get broken, and we're all together, together. Hurting would be over. If only you'd believe me when I said you're beautiful, the images would manifest. only I could show you what immaculate could be. The negative would perish and the positive would be. If only you'd allow yourself to hear what I just said, then pretty soon you'd realize that immaculate is sitting in your head. Circle, and my neck got broke and my mind got blown.